This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: the U.S. Embassy in Iraq comes under a rocket attack hours after drones and missiles targeted two bases hosting American troops in western and northern Iraq. The Israeli military blows up the house of a Palestinian prisoner near the city of Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. And the UN Security Council condemns the assassination of Haiti's president and calls on all parties to avoid any act that could contribute to further instability. Hello and welcome, everybody. The U.S. Embassy inside Baghdad's Green Zone has been targeted with several rockets. That's the third attack against American installations in Iraq in the past 24 hours. Iraqi security forces said the embassy's anti-rocket system diverted one of the projectiles while one fell near the zone's perimeter. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack, yet the strike came hours after rockets hit Ain al-Assad Air Base, a military installation in western Iraq that houses U.S. troops. Early Wednesday, security forces said armed drones hit a U.S. base at Erbil Airport in the northern Kurdistan region.
Iraq's Ain al-Assad Air Base hosting American forces has come under a fresh rocket attack. A spokesman for the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq said two personnel were injured after more than a dozen missiles targeted the facility. Less than a day earlier, a U.S. base at Erbil Airport in northern Kurdistan region was targeted as well. Security sources in Erbil said armed drones were used in the attack, which prompted the suspension of flights at the airport. These incidents are nothing new. Supply convoys for the U.S.-led military coalition in Iraq have come under repeated attacks over the past months. Anti-American sentiments have been on the rise since Washington's assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes in January last year. Shortly after the killing of the two iconic anti-terror figures, the Iraqi parliament unanimously voted to end the American military presence. The legislation has fallen on deaf ears as the United States seems unwilling to leave the Arab country. On the ground, things look simple. The Iraqis do not want American troops on their soil. Why is it, then, one may ask, that the U.S. refuses to end its costly intervention there?
They are, pretending to fight the Islamic State or Daesh, but reality is they've been funding it, supporting it, and bringing in members of the Al-Qaeda, which means the database, into Syria and to Iraq as a way of destabilizing the area and to create opportunities for the Americans.
The United States, that had invaded Iraq before, sent thousands of new troops there in 2014 under the pretext of fighting Daesh terrorists. Baghdad declared victory over the terror group in 2017, but Washington has shown no sign of intending to leave the oil-rich nation. The U.S. cites the continued threat of Daesh as the reason for its long, drawn-out stay in Iraq, but what it's done over the past years put its stated purpose in question. Washington has regularly launched attacks on the positions of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units, an umbrella organization which was the key in defeating Daesh. Such strikes have been strongly condemned by Iraqi political and military figures, as well as the public, who regard the U.S. military presence as the main source of tensions in the country.
Elsewhere, Israel has demolished the house of a Palestinian prisoner in the occupied West Bank. The house of Muntasir Shalabi, located near the city of Ramallah, was blown up by Israeli forces in the early hours of Thursday. Israel says Shalabi carried out a second drive-by shooting in the West Bank that killed an Israeli and wounded two others. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has slammed the demolition, calling it a barbaric and a terrorist behavior practiced by criminal gangs. An Israeli court approved the demolition of the house last month in line with its policy of demolishing the family homes of attackers after they are killed or arrested. Rights groups have time and again slammed this policy and say it violates international laws. The Afghanistan Defense Ministry says government forces have taken back the control of a western provincial capital that was stormed by the Taliban. A spokesman for the ministry said the capital city of Badghis province, Qalaino, is fully back under the government's control. He said, however, operations against the Taliban continue on the outskirts of the city, and hundreds of fresh troops have been deployed to the region. He said 69 Taliban fighters had been killed during the fighting. Taliban militants briefly seized key government buildings in the city on Wednesday in their first major assault on a provincial capital. The Taliban have increased their attacks on Afghan cities and villages since May and have already seized dozens of rural districts. A correspondent, Amin Alami, is joining us now from the Afghan capital, Kabul, with all the latest. Amin, what details do you have to share with us?
Well, Badia, Qalaino, the capital city of Badghis province in western Afghanistan, is currently under the control of Afghan security forces, and many governmental bodies are operating inside the city. Local officials, including the governor of Badghis, as well as the police and Afghan National Army commanders in that province, also confirmed that a fierce fighting is underway between Afghan security forces and the Taliban militants in the suburbs and outskirts of the city. They also say that counterattack operation is going on very slowly, and this is because, according to these local military officials in Qalaino, the Taliban are using residential areas, mainly houses of villagers, as a shield to launch, to defend themselves against Afghan military forces' attacks there. In the meantime, Afghan officials here in Kabul say that besides launching deadly military operations and attacks in western Badghis province of Afghanistan, Afghan security forces could successfully eliminate dozens of Taliban militants in eastern Afghanistan as well. Based on reports issued by Afghanistan's defense ministry, over 40 Taliban militants were killed as a result of Afghan military operations in Nangarhar, Khost, Paktia, and Paktika provinces. All of these provinces are located in eastern Afghanistan, and all of them are located on the borderline with Pakistan. This area, I mean the border area, is very important for both the Afghan government and the Taliban. And this is because the Afghan government believes that defending these borders means stopping the further advances of the Taliban militants into Afghanistan from the Pakistani soil, because the border areas known as free areas are not either under the control of the Afghan government or Pakistani government, but instead different terrorist groups, including the Afghan Taliban, the Pakistani Taliban, or the TTP, and Al-Qaeda, individuals or commanders are stationed along the border with Pakistan, mainly in tribal areas. In the eyes of Afghan military sources, mainly Afghan Defense Ministry, launching heavy military operations alongside the borders of Afghanistan, mainly in eastern and northern parts of this country, will help Afghan security forces to bring the rest of districts and provinces under their own control. You may know that the Taliban in the recent weeks captured many key ports in northern Afghanistan that connects Afghanistan with some other countries, including Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. But Afghan security forces say that the public uprising forces successfully launched counterattack operations alongside with the Afghan security forces and pushed back the Taliban from most of the areas in northern Afghanistan.
All right, thanks a lot. Amin Alami joining us from the Afghan capital, Kabul. Moving on, U.S. authorities have called off the search for survivors of a June condominium tower collapse in Miami.
At this point, we have truly exhausted every option available to us in the search and rescue mission. So today is about beginning the transition to recovery so that we can help to bring closure to the families who've been suffering and waiting for news. Nothing we can do can bring back those we've lost, but we can and we will do everything in our power possible to identify all of the victims and to offer closure to the families in this time of unimaginable grief.
Cava added family members of the victims have been notified about the decision. She said the possibility of someone still alive is near zero. Authorities say there is some possibility that some of those still unaccounted for will be found elsewhere or have been double counted. This is while the remains of 18 more victims were removed from the pile of the debris on Wednesday, leaving 86 people still missing of those believed to have been inside the building. Crews have so far extracted the remains of 54 people from the rubble. Several countries in the Asia-Pacific region have reported more coronavirus deaths and infections as they struggle with a new wave of the virus, largely driven by the Delta variant. Thailand has recorded a new daily record of 75 deaths, as well as 7,000 more cases. The figures push the country's overall death toll to more than 2,400 and the caseload to over 300,000. South Korea logged its highest ever one-day rise of nearly 1,300 infections. Officials consider imposing a semi-lockdown in the capital, Seoul, which is the epicenter of the new wave. India also reported nearly 46,000 new infections, pushing the tally to 30.71 million. India's death toll stands at over 405,000. Meanwhile, Australia's already locked-down state of New South Wales reported 38 cases on Thursday, its biggest daily rise in 2021. The state's total infections are now nearing 400. Elsewhere, Haitian police say they've killed four people and arrested two others from a group allegedly behind the assassination of the country's president, Jovenel Moïse. The Director General of National Police said three policemen who were taken hostage by assailants have also been recovered. He, however, did not specify the identity of the armed men who attacked Moïse's residence on the outskirts of the capital, Port-au-Prince, fatally killing him and injuring the First Lady early on Wednesday. Interim Prime Minister Claude Joseph has already declared a national state of siege and announced being in charge of the country. The UN Security Council has condemned the assassination of Haiti's head of state. In a statement, the council urged calm and called on political stakeholders to refrain from any acts of violence. Political commentator Nicholas Ayala says the sequence of events unfolding in the immediate aftermath of Moise's assassination points to a power grab by the country's right-wing forces.
Now, it seems to be Claude, if we look at the new acting Prime Minister Claude Joseph, who was a former member of the GNB, which was a student movement which participated in the 2004 coup against Aristide, it seems to be that those right-wing oligarchic forces that were part of the overthrow of Aristide back in 2004 are attempting to seize power in Haiti and have essentially pushed out Moise, who lost a lot of his support from the oligarchic class after the large uprising we saw in Haiti in February. So it seems to be a power play by certain segments of the Haitian ruling class in order to really consolidate their control. The state of siege that you mentioned really kind of reaffirms that idea, because what that essentially means is that the army is taking over the policing matters of the country, the media is being taken over by the state, and other very repressive measures. The fear now is that they may attempt to call for another UN occupation of Haiti, which, as we remember from last time, went very poorly for the Haitian people and really meant more repression, more deaths, and more destruction for the island.
South Africa's former president Jacob Zuma has turned himself over to the police to serve 15 months in jail for contempt of court. Zuma's foundation said the former president has decided to comply with the incarceration order. A police spokesman confirmed Zuma was in the care of the security forces in compliance with the constitutional court sentence. Last month, the constitutional court sentenced Zuma for defying an instruction earlier this year to give evidence at a corruption inquiry. Zuma had earlier asked the court to annul his sentence on the grounds that it's excessive and could expose him to COVID-19. The former president is accused of graft and corruption during his tenure between 2009 and 2018. Zuma rejects all allegations as being politically motivated. And Sudan has condemned Ethiopia for starting the next phase of filling the controversial mega dam on the Nile River, considering it a clear violation of international law. Press TV correspondent in Khartoum, Mohamed Ali Fezari, has more in this report.
Sudan condemns Ethiopia's start of second phase of filling the controversial Nile Dam, warning the move violates existing agreements and threatens security in the region. The warning came after Sudan's Minister of Irrigation and Water Resources received a letter from Ethiopian counterpart informing him of the start of the second filling of the dam during the current rainy season. Despite drums of war appear, the government of Sudan ruled out any military solution to resettle the situation.
I think the military option, to my understanding, is out of question. It's not going to happen, especially for Sudan, because the battle will be in Sudan. And maybe Ethiopia will retaliate if they attack Gerd. Maybe they are going to retaliate in Osiris Dam or anywhere else. And the areas there will be affected. So, and this is not the solution.
Experts insist that no other option rather than negotiation within the international law is available for Sudan. Last month, Sudan and Egypt had sent letters asking the UN Security Council to take up the issue. Talks mediated by the African Union most recently in the Democratic Republic of Congo have repeatedly stalled. According to Sudanese authorities, the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam is being built about 15 kilometers from border with Sudan on the Blue Nile, the source of most of the Nile's water, yet it affects life of 20 million people in this area.
As experts say, with the starting the next phase of filling the controversial mega dam on the Nile River by Ethiopia, the ball is now on the court of Sudan and Egypt. But as things stand, the two countries are still waiting for an action by the UN. Mohamed Ali Fezari, Khartoum.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. Health tourism. In the name of God, Salam, dear listeners, and welcome to the program. This is the first program in our new radio series, Medical and Health Tourism. In this new series, we're going to discuss medical tourism and Iran's activities and initiatives in this important field of tourism. Also, in each episode of our program, we shall focus on the activities of a reputable and well-known Iranian hospital or medical center, which is active in the field of medical tourism, and take a closer look at the International Patients Department, IPD, at each of these medical facilities. The program will familiarize you, dear listeners, with the achievements of these medical centers and the facilities and services they offer prospective patients, and also how to get in touch with these medical centers. Dear listeners, in the first episode of our program, Medical Tourism in Iran, you will get to know more about medical tourism and the tourism industry in general. Accompany us in this series. Traveling is a truly enriching experience. The valuable learning experience you get from traveling is unequaled. When it comes to learning about life, there is nothing more enriching than traveling. Traveling also leaves you with lasting and fond memories. In the past, people traveled to earn a living, to increase their income, to engage in commerce or trade, or set off on a religious pilgrimage or sought adventure in a foreign land. But given the risks and dangers which are inherent in traveling, many people eschew travel and certainly were wary of making long-distance journeys. Roads were often unsafe. But that is all history now. Today, with advances in technology and industry and the invention of modern means of public transport, cars, railways, air travel, etc., traveling is no longer considered inaccessible or difficult. Today, many people, with a variety of reasons and intentions, embark on short, medium, and long-distance journeys to lands both far away and close by. Thus, a global tourism industry has taken shape. Tourism industry in today's world has become a leading industry. This industry is so well developed that nowadays it is considered the third most profitable and lucrative industry in the world. The word tour in tourism is derived from the Latin word tournare, meaning the movement around a central point or axis. When combined with the suffixes ism and ist, they suggest the action of movement around a circle. One can argue that a circle represents a round trip. You start from a point and ultimately return back to the same beginning. Therefore, like a circle, a tour represents a journey that is a round trip. That is the act of leaving and then returning to the original starting point, and therefore one who takes such a journey can be called a tourist. However, according to the World Tourism Organization, UNWTO, a tourist or a visitor is defined as a traveler taking a trip to a main destination outside his or her usual environment for less than a year for any main purpose, including business, leisure, or other personal purpose, other than to be employed by a resident entity in the country or place visited. Tourism industry, in fact, consists of a collection of activities, services, and industries which provide travelers and tourists with accommodation, public transportation, food, entertainment, shopping malls, and retail outlets, medical services, etc. Thank you. The tourism industry is being developed in many countries and is very much in the spotlight these days, since it leads to cultural exchanges between countries, brings countries and peoples closer together, creates jobs, aids the economy, and can play a significant role in reducing poverty and unemployment. Many countries are trying to attract foreign tourists by highlighting their history, cultural and historical heritage, archaeology, interesting places to see, attractive cuisine, beautiful and pristine natural settings, wonderful scenery, etc. Today, based on the purpose for which a traveler embarks on a journey, the tourism industry can be subdivided into several branches. There are many reasons for traveling, some of which may be to explore the history and civilization of a country, to enjoy the beauty of nature, environment, and natural attractions, which many countries have to offer, to learn a new language and experience a new culture, to travel for a religious pilgrimage, to simply relax and get away from it all, or to receive advanced medical treatment, which may be unavailable or very expensive in your own country. If you don't know much about medical and health tourism, but would really like to find about it out, then follow this series of informative radio programs, which tells you all about it. Presently, the future of medical tourism is expected to remain profitable, as experts predict considerable revenue growth for the coming years. According to a definition adopted by the World Tourism Organization, UNWTO, a health tourist can make a journey from his country in order to take advantage of the medical facilities of the destination country and recover his mental and physical health. Not only does medical tourism help you receive the best treatment in a foreign land with a fraction of the cost in a developed country, it also provides an opportunity for the other country's economic recovery and economic growth, so basically it's a win-win situation for all. Medical tourism or health tourism is one major reason why tourists visit a country. In fact, health tourism is a kind of tourism which seeks to preserve, promote, and recover the mental and physical health of the tourist. The period of travel can be anything from 24 hours up to 1 year or even more. Millions of people travel abroad for medical treatment, from dental work to major heart surgery, all done at a fraction of the cost back home. Medical tourism is a certainly lucrative business worldwide. When people travel from one place to another place across the international border to receive some form of medical treatment, is called medical tourism. Another definition of a medical tourist is someone who crosses borders to obtain health care in an environment outside their own. Well, since the mid-20th century, health care costs have exploded in many developed and industrialized countries. For those without health insurance, medical tourism represents a viable and beneficial alternative. Medical tourism has existed since Greek and Roman times. It later expanded to several other European countries and then to other regions of the world. Since ancient times, mineral water, hot spring bath, spas, and therapeutic water treatment have all been used to promote human health. It is worth mentioning that medical tourism includes many different types, such as wellness tourism, curative tourism, and so on. Medical tourism is considered a critical kind of tourism among all the different types of tourism, since it deals with people's body and health. Thus, medical tourists are expected to do meticulous research before deciding to embark on this type of journey. It is very important for prospective medical tourists to get accurate information about reliable and reputable hospitals, their acceptance as a patient at such facilities, as well as their place of residence in the destination country. Various organizations and companies can offer valuable advice and assistance to prospective medical tourists, helping them to choose, providing them with accurate information about the destination country, obtaining medical visas, medical services on offer, and so on. In medical tourism, numerous services will be readily offered to prospective patients, from general surgeries to dental care, plastic surgery, etc., all depending on what medical tourist requires. The patients can also benefit from different touristic services aside from medical care, such as entertainment, visiting museums, interesting places to see, etc. Thus, in order to bring in the medical tourist, countries need to have the right infrastructure in place. They need well-equipped modern hospitals, experienced and well-trained doctors, nurses, and medical staff, state-of-the-art medical facilities, and appropriate medical rules. These are all part of the required infrastructure for attracting, absorbing health tourists. Countries can start to prepare the ground for medical tourism by combining residential services with touristic facilities. The more a country can offer high-quality medical services at a competitive and reasonable price, the more medical tourists it will attract, securing a larger share of this lucrative market. Having the appropriate medical laws to protect patients is also an important factor when trying to attract medical tourists from abroad. As we mentioned earlier, medical tourism is an important subcategory of tourism which has drawn government and public attention in recent decades. Medical tourism is a fast-growing area of tourism, and many countries are competing with one another for a bigger market share. It goes without saying that these tourists can generate huge revenues for the destination country, and their stay is even more profitable if it is for an extended period of time. More than 300 million people in the world travel annually with the aim of benefiting from medical tourism services. The $600 billion medical tourism market is growing all the time, and Asia has become a popular destination for tourists due to the prohibitively expensive cost of medical treatment in Western industrialized countries. Medical services in Asia is relatively cheap and of a high standard. Traveling to Asia is easy, and the quality of medical services on offer in many Asian countries is comparable to what is offered in Western countries. Medical technology and medical standards in Asia have improved markedly. Another important factor is that patients promptly receive the medical services they need and are kept waiting for far shorter periods of time compared to Western countries. Some of the popular Asian countries in the field of medical tourism are Iran, Turkey, Malaysia, Saudi Arabia, Indonesia, India, Bahrain, China, and Thailand. Dear listeners, we have come to the end of our first episode of Medical and Health Tourism. In our next program, we shall focus on medical tourism in the Islamic Republic of Iran, one of the most popular and successful countries in this field. We shall also look at the services which Iranian hospitals and clinics have to offer. Until then, goodbye and God bless. the spotlight.
Welcome to the spotlight. I'm Kavitat Way. Iraq's Ain al-Assad airbase, hosting American forces, has come under a fresh rocket attack. This is the second such attack this week on the base in Iraq's western Anbar province. Ain al-Assad was also hit by 3 rockets on Monday. The latest attack came less than a day after drones hit another U.S. base at Erbil Airport in the northern Kurdistan. The U.S. is not welcomed in Iraq, and that is showing itself, with it coming under attack so frequently. So why is the U.S. so keen in staying in Iraq? Stay tuned to the spotlight.
Iraq's Ain al-Assad airbase hosting American forces has come under a fresh rocket attack. A spokesman for the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq said 2 personnel were injured after more than a dozen missiles targeted the facility. Less than a day earlier, a U.S. base at Erbil Airport in northern Kurdistan region was targeted as well. Security sources in Erbil said armed drones were used in the attack, which prompted the suspension of flights at the airport. These incidents are nothing new. Supply convoys for the U.S.-led military coalition in Iraq have come under repeated attacks over the past months. Anti-American sentiments have been on the rise since Washington's assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes in January last year. Shortly after the killing of the 2 iconic anti-terror figures, the Iraqi parliament unanimously voted to end the American military presence. The legislation has fallen on deaf ears as the United States seems unwilling to leave the Arab country. On the ground, things look simple. The Iraqis do not want American troops on their soil. Why is it, then, one may ask, that the U.S. refuses to end its costly intervention there? The United States, that had invaded Iraq before, sent thousands of new troops there in 2014 under the pretext of fighting Daesh terrorists. Baghdad declared victory over the terror group in 2017, but Washington has shown no sign of intending to leave the oil-rich nation. The U.S. cites the continued threat of Daesh as the reason for its long, drawn-out stay in Iraq. But what it's done over the past years put its stated purpose in question. Washington has regularly launched attacks on the positions of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units, an umbrella organization which was the key in defeating Daesh. Such strikes have been strongly condemned by Iraqi political and military figures, as well as the public, who regard the U.S. military presence as the main source of tensions in the country.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, we have Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition joining us from San Francisco. Also like to welcome Edward Corrigan, international human rights lawyer, joining us from London, Ontario. Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. Richard Becker, let me start with you and ask you a simple question. Why are U.S. troops in Iraq? Why does the U.S. insist to stay in Iraq?
Well, it's a very interesting question. You know, we have to take note that it was just several days ago last week that one of the architects of the invasion and occupation of Iraq, Donald Rumsfeld, died. Rumsfeld is a war criminal. At the time of the invasion, he was asked, how long would the U.S. troops be there? This was in April or May of 2003, and he said, well, it might be 5 days or 5 weeks or 5 months, but I guarantee you it won't be any longer than that. Well, now it's 219 months. It's more than 18 years, actually, that the U.S. has been in Iraq. And the occupation is one that grew out of the neocons' twisted vision of how they could remake the world, and that the invasion and occupation of Iraq would be a step toward a complete transformation of the region. You know, they even in the summer of 2003 came up with a new design for an Iraqi flag, I remember, that looked remarkably like the Israeli flag. It was blue and white and then had a little bit of yellow in it. But this whole idea, this illusion that they could change the whole world, and then once in the country, the occupation became bogged down. It became a quagmire. Despite what Rumsfeld said before Congress that I don't do quagmires, the U.S. almost lost the war, and only was able to not have a complete defeat by hiring a lot of the resistance who had been fighting against them, paying them off not to shoot at the U.S. troops. But this is part of, and it remains a part of, a strategy of global domination. That is the fundamental strategy of the U.S. since World War II, and especially since the fall of the Soviet Union, that they could remake the world, they could seize key countries and resources, and by doing so with 800 military bases around the world, sustained domination. But you can see that it's really not working in Iraq, and that the demands grow louder for the U.S. to get out.
Exactly, and this past week has been just that, Edward Corrigan. And even the weeks before, where we're looking at attacks that have happened at Ain al-Assad airbase twice in a week, and we're looking at the drones that hit Erbil. Really an increase in attacks, but it's been slowly but surely increasing, not just this week, but over the past year, even longer, even though it's been sporadic. What do you make of the attacks that happened this week? Were you having them to have happened consecutively?
Well, it sends a message that the attacks were coordinated, and that there was at least three attacks that were launched at the same time against American targets, I guess two in Iraq and one in Syria. So there's a level of cooperation between the groups that are opposed to the American occupation forces in Syria and also the American occupation forces in Iraq. So that sends a message, just not random sporadic resistance from, you know, individuals. It's sort of, you know, loosely organized. I'm not saying it's highly, you know, centralized, but it shows that there's a degree of coordination. And of course, the Americans are the target because they're, you know, looting oil and other resources from Syria, and they've got no permission to be there from the Syrian government. There's no Security Council resolution authorizing their presence. Same thing in Iraq. The Iraqi parliament has asked them to leave by unanimous resolution. There's no Security Council resolution. What's interesting, the American position or justification for staying there keeps evolving. It keeps changing. The troops stay, but the excuse keeps changing. Initially, it was because, you know, Iraq was involved with the attack on 9/11, and then it had weapons of mass destruction. Both of those are lies. Then it became, to fight against, you know, the Islamic State, which also has been basically been eradicated, except for the support the Americans that our allies are giving it, moving them around. And of course, the people that are actually fighting the Islamic State, General Soleimani and General al-Mahdis, you know, they were assassinated in Iraq, and this is, you know, one of the top Iraqi generals killed by the Americans in his own country. And General Soleimani was there as the main, you know, person organizing the fight against the Islamic State, and he had been there at the invitation of the Iraqi government. This was a very flagrant violation, and also, in my view, a calculation to sort of raise tensions in the area, tend to have conflict, which, you know, the people pushing the buttons in Washington don't have to deal with. But of course, the soldiers on the ground in the desert and sweating in the heat, they're the ones that have the consequences of it. Another thing is that when there was attack on the base, people, they fired back, but just random. They didn't have a target. They just fired at civilian population as a sort of a knee-jerk reaction. And that actually is a war crime, because they were not targeting military people. They just were sending random shells into a civilian population, which did do some damage and injure some civilians. So that is a concern. It's not like they knew who was firing at them and then they retaliated in a pinpoint way. This was just general, you know, artillery shells fired at the Iraqi population, which is not going to make the Americans very favored in that area. And of course, it just antagonizes the Iraqi people more and, you know, puts pressure. But the Americans aren't listening to any sort of, oral requests. So the tension has been escalating now to attacks against the American soldiers. But as I said, this has been all evolving. You know, it's now, 18 years? Right. And, you know, they obviously are interested in the oil. And the other factor is, I don't think any president wants to say that we lost Iraq and we got kicked out and none of them want to have to leave with their tail between their legs. I think that's also part of the reason why the Americans have stayed so long in Afghanistan. but they haven't won, but they don't want to be tagged with losing Afghanistan or losing Iraq or losing Syria, even though their positions there are totally illegal.
Well, let's get one thing out of the way if we can with you, Richard Becker, and that is the assassination that took place of the late Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and also Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas, which was a key architect for the PMU forces, which are considered part of the Iraqi military. We know that they were key and central in the fight against Daesh terrorists, of which they were able to eliminate them. So the question has come up, why would the U.S. assassinate these two figures? One camp says it's because the U.S. wants to have Daesh terrorists somewhat still there, so it could guide them, because there is this theory out there that, and many believe that it's actually true, that the U.S. does, in either directly or indirectly or covertly, support the Daesh terror group, or elements of these terrorist groups are supported by the U.S. Do you think that is the case, one of the reasons why these two were eliminated, assassinated?
Well, I think that the carrying out of the assassinations, which was a truly criminal act, as your other guest, Sir Corrigan, indicated, it brought the region really to the brink of a much wider war. And I think that the Trump administration, which when Trump and his generals having ordered this assassination, then had to pull back in what was clearly, the ANSA coalition that I'm part of called for demonstrations, and there were 90 demonstrations on just a couple of days' notice in the U.S. and showing that there was a great deal of anti-war sentiment inside the United States, a great deal of condemnation of what the United States did around the world. But this is a part of the ongoing war against Iran that's going on. It's not an all-out military conflict now, but the sanctions, which are an act of war against that country, the recurrent assassinations that are taking place, not only these that you mentioned that in January of 2020, but many assassinations that have taken place of scientists and other figures, and the attacks on shipping, on Iranian shipping. And so we can see that this is going on, is that there's, the U.S. is trying to, wanted to defeat, I believe, wanted to at least reduce very greatly the hold of ISIS, and particularly on a large part of Syrian and Iraqi territory. But continues to use different forces for what it sees as its advantage. I mean, this is cynical. At the same time, we have the U.S. government talking about lack of democratic rights, and that's why they're doing what they do to Iran with the sanctions in Cuba and Venezuela, et cetera, et cetera. But in reality, there's a very cynical power game that's going on, and different elements come into play in the U.S. strategy at different points in time and become more or less important. But that assassination, that was a part of the ongoing war against Iran.
Mm-hmm. Edward Corrigan, that is exactly one of the reasons that the Iraqi prime minister and Iraqi parliamentarians and Iraqis themselves, I'm sure, but the high-ranking Iraqi officials are saying, do not use our soil to settle your score or your differences with Iran, in a message to the U.S., especially not only last week when the U.S. attacked that same position on the Syria-Iraq border, where you had three of the PMU forces actually get killed, but the previous times, especially when Donald Trump said we want to use Iraq to spy on Iran. The U.S. clearly is not wanted by Iraq. It's definitely not wanted in Syria. Which comes back to my original question here, what is so important for the U.S. when it comes to Iraq? If we want to take a look at one reasoning that's been given, is that Iraq is used as a gateway into Syria. Do you think that that is the case?
Well, I think it is partially the case, because Iraq is centrally positioned, and it's a great forward staging area if you want to put pressure or attack Syria. Also to attack Iran, and it also, the Americans are concerned that the Shia in Iraq are, you know, forming close ties with Iran. So there's a joke saying who won the war in Iraq, and the answer is Iran. So they want to destabilize the area. They actually have a map of Iraq broken up into different areas, a Kurdish area, a Shia area, a Sunni area, and, you know, to break the states down so that they would still have, you know, sectarian conflict, but also be much weaker and easier to control. Former Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu said that they wanted Daesh because it was a very useful tool, a weapon. And if you look at it, the Israelis, the Americans through the CIA and other groups were supporting, you know, the Islamic State and bringing them arms and supplying them and to help them to destabilize the area. And if you look at the Islamic State, their attacks almost have all been against, you know, the Arabs and the Muslims in the area and tried to provoke conflict. They were targeting the Alawites and the Druze in Syria. They were targeting Shia positions and leaders. And the one thing they weren't doing, they weren't attacking Israel. There was a little bit of a problem where when Israel was taking out injured members of the Islamic State and treating them in Israel, a bunch of the Druze in Israel went and attacked them and killed them because Daesh was attacking the Druze in Syria. So that was a little interesting episode where the Israeli Druze struck out against Daesh, which is being, you know, helped by the Israelis, and because of their cousins and relatives that were in Syria that were being targeted by Daesh, because the Islamic State is sort of a Sunni fundamentalist movement, and they don't like the Shia, they don't like the Alawites, they don't like the Druze, they don't even like a lot of the Sunnis who don't take their extreme view. But a lot of this is fabricated, and it's, you know, somebody's fanning the flames to provoke these sectarian conflicts in the area. And this is an age-old strategy that the British use. It even goes back to the Roman times. You know, divide them up, have them fighting. And, you know, there's evidence that, you know, it was the British and the Americans that were going around causing some of these attacks. There was a celebrated incident where a couple British soldiers mm-hmm. were dressed up as Arabs and had weapons in the car and bombs, and they were stopped in Basra, arrested by the Iraqi authorities, which are aligned with the Americans. And the British sent tanks into the police chamber or the police prison to break these guys out. But why were they there? What was their purpose? Why did they have these weapons? Why were they in disguise? And why did the British just not ask them? Because this is, you know, their allies that had caught these British soldiers. And, you know, it looks as though, and the evidence, there's multiple examples that it was actually the British and the Americans and possibly right. the Israelis that were blowing these things up and trying to get conflict between the Shias and the Sunnis, which would, of course, you know, would truly ravage and destroy Iraq even more than already had been done.
Well, you know, this is what's confusing here, and it really puts a question mark as to the U.S. purposes. Richard Bricker, you did say, and you have said, that the U.S. Also is really sending messages to Iran in terms of what it is doing in Iraq with the attacks. I believe the stance that the U.S. has, obviously very anti-Iran. But the U.S. has also made announcements, like in April. It announced jointly after a strategic dialogue under Joe Biden with Iraq that they will withdraw their forces eventually out of the country. Did not provide a timeline, however. They also did pull out roughly about 2,300 to 2,500 troops out of the 5,400 that they had. So you still have a contingent that remains there. And you also had just recently where the U.S. announced the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and a couple other countries that included THAAD missiles, so forth and so on. And this was in the Wall Street Journal, where it also cited that because the U.S. possibly is going to reach a deal with Iran, that it no longer will need these forces in the West Asia region. So what is the U.S. stance, really? Are they going to pull out, or is just they're trying to find the right time for it?
Well, eventually the continents will come back together, too. If we talk about, you know, eventual, what does that word even mean? The U.S. considers the region to be still of great importance, I would say in a certain way of diminishing importance from the point of view of the the U.S. global strategy. It's clear that the, and if you follow any of the military publications in the U.S., that they're preparing for war against China. There's a shift of forces. The pivot to Asia that started under Obama is intensifying. And the preparations for war are intensifying. So there is a desire on the part of the, I think, of the U.S. To, I think that they will sign some kind of an agreement with Iran. We don't know what it will be, and I'm not really predicting that, but I think that they're looking in Washington and the Pentagon and in the national security apparatus is looking at ways to diminish its overreach in certain areas in order to overreach in another area, in other words, in Asia and against China. But the tactics that continue to go on of this divide and conquer, last year was the 100th anniversary of the Great Arab Revolt, where there were uprisings in Syria and Lebanon, and particularly in Iraq and Egypt and Palestine, when the people found out, the Arab people found out, and the Kurdish people too, that their territory was being redivided, and now not from the Ottoman Empire, but among the British and the French empires. And you know, at that time, and this is something to remember, is that the imams of the Sunni and Shia mosques went into each other's mosques in 1920 in Iraq and preached unity against British colonialism. So there's that tradition too, that the British and the U.S. and the French have, you know, the colonizers have all practiced promotion of disunity at great cost to the people of the region, the people who were colonized by the and are okay. Neo-colonists of the United States today.
Thank you very much. We're going to unfortunately have to end it there. Let me thank our guest, Richard Becker, who was talking there from the Answer Coalition. Edward Corrigan, thank you very much. International human rights lawyer from London, Ontario. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Do join us next time. From Mikko Vitale, the entire team, it's goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Aifel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين